Welcome to the Portion Podcast, a weekly discussion of the Torah portion of the week. I am your co-host, Aaron Roller, and I'm here with your other co-host, Rabbi Jonathan Bienenfeld.
Hi, all.
How are your students doing? Anything funny on your WhatsApp with your high school students?
Nothing that I can repeat on air. They post some of the craziest memes, those kids.
Do you get the sense that they are trying to use some discretion, knowing that you're looking at what they're posting?
Yeah, my sense has been that there are sort of parallel WhatsApp groups. There's one that I'm on, and then there are others that I'm not. So it's somewhat sterilized, which I appreciate, boys. Thanks very much.
And are your students listening to the show?
Not a chance.
Uh-huh.
They hear enough of me during the week.
They don't need extra time. There's probably a lesson, you know, that they're developing some good judgment maybe in running parallel WhatsApp groups.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that they're exercising good judgment in trying to listen to me as seldom as possible, and I was going to thank you for that.
No, I wouldn't put it quite that way.
At least not in my presence.
So this week's Parsha is Parsha Vayetze, the Parsha of and he left. Yaakov runs away. He runs away from his brother Esav, his murderous brother, after he's negotiated away the birthright and stolen the blessing from him. All right, so we start the parsha with Yaakov leaving, and so I was struck that like this week's parsha seems. We talked about kind of how Bereishit and Noach start as like really seemingly in like a world of not that it's not real, but it's like a world of myth. Like it's a world that like we can't even imagine. It seems outside of the realm of our understanding, with miracles and talking snakes and, you know, magic gardens and floods and all these things. And then we get to, you know, things seem more placed in the real world without Abraham and Yitzchak. But it seems like with this week's parsha, as we get to Yaakov, there's like a psychological depth. Not that it wasn't there completely with Abraham and Yitzchak, but like in terms of like business and family life, and there's just like it seems like there's a larger dose of realism in this week's parsha. What do you think?
I think so. I think that goes back even to last week's parsha. I mean, I think the idea that you have quarreling brothers, that you have a sense from, you know, different parents about what each child perhaps is capable of. You have, again, similar to this week's parsha that we'll see between Yaakov and Laban, you have this whole, you know, negotiation between Yaakov and Esav in trying to purchase the birthright. I think you start to see a lot of that last week, also with Yitzhak last week in terms of his sojourning in Grar, the wells, and redigging the wells and trying to sort of recreate what the previous generation has already established, and, you know, something about almost the, you know, continuity of the generations. But certainly that does continue at least into this week's parsha. I think what's unusual about this week's parsha is that it's punctuated by the fantastic and by the over the top.
The dream of the ladder.
The dream of the ladder. It's just so over the top. The manner in which Yaakov actually becomes wealthy. We don't know how it was that Yitzchak in last week's parsha was able to plant and then seize a hundredfold return that was miraculous.
Right, says it.
Yeah, sort of the miraculous through nature. What happens at the end of the parsha here with Yaakov somehow or another manipulating the flocks of sheep of Lavan and getting this huge product, this huge birthing of all these very specific kinds of sheep that he was after. It's all very, it's odd. It's all really weird.
So I want to get to that a little bit later, but I want to focus first on the dream that he has as he's leaving. Cause I was thinking about that we talked about Abraham as being like the movement leader. Like he creates the movement, and how without a Yitzchak, without somebody who kind of follows through and sort of lives by those tenets and is maybe not the biggest innovator in his own right, that helps to sustain it. It helps to kind of institutionalize the things that are, you know, the things that Abraham lives for and make it so that, you know, a regular person is going to kind of live that life. But with Yaakov, so I'm thinking about like, I was struck by the fact that he says to God, like after he has this dream, and we should talk about the specifics of the dream, but he says, and I'm using the Art Scroll translation here, if God will be with me, will guard me on this way that I am going, will give me bread to eat and clothes to wear, and I return to peace in peace to my father's house, and Hashem will be a God to me. Then this stone, which I have set up as a pillar, shall become a house of God, and whatever you will give me, I shall repeatedly tithe to you. It's that idea of like, im yihi Elohim, if you will be a God to me. Like, it seems so weird. He has gone to such lengths to secure this blessing from his father that, like, you're like, what do you mean, if you will be a God to me? Like, isn't it a foregone conclusion that he believes in, you know, in the God of Abraham and this monotheistic vision? And what I was struck by is that probably until this moment, on a certain level, it could have been taken for granted, because this is just the home you grow up in. He's three generations deep. And he is, you know, this is the world he's in. He's like literally a man of tents. Like, he's in the tent. He's like, that's, you grow up with certain assumptions. And this is maybe the first moment of his life where he is like, he's outside of that. He's outside of his hometown. He's away from mom and dad. And those assumptions that he lived with are gone. And all of a sudden, not that he didn't have it before. Like, I think it's a difference of like being bar mitzvahed and like going to college, right? They say you're a man when you're a bar mitzvah, and, you know, now the mitzvahs count for real. But like, then you go away and you're not in your parents' house. There's nobody forcing you to do anything. You have to decide for yourself. Is this, you know, am I really going to do mitzvahs? Am I really going to go to shul? Am I really going to keep Shabbos? And I think that that's like this moment for Yaakov on a certain, like, on a much greater level, perhaps, in terms of both, you know, the philosophical depth of it. But like, he's out there and he says, like, wow, this is, you know, like, I'm having my own relationship with God here. So it just struck me that, like, that's, on a certain level, it's more profound for us. It speaks to us, or at least I found this speaking to me more deeply, because whereas you have, you know, Avraham creates the movement and Yitzhak is like, you know, helping his dad make sure that the movement kind of becomes something, you know, becomes a religion, so to speak. But like, Yaakov is like he's like the first person who's like really, you know, from birth, so to speak, or he's the person who's really growing up with it in a way where it's already an institution.
So shouldn't that be framed more than as Yaakov's wondering, not so much, God, are you going to be with me, but God, am I really going to be with you? Is this almost a euphemistic way of phrasing that? Meaning, if I'm going to follow suit, then God, you'll be with me. And if not, I'm not sure.
I think it goes both ways, right? I mean, so now that gives us a great segue into the ladder, right? The ladder is one where there's going up and there's coming down. And, you know, and the relationship is just that. It's there's relationship there. I don't think he's saying, yeah, God, if you'll be with me, like he's, you know, blackmailing God or something like that. But I think that there's a degree of like maybe taking ownership. He's taking ownership in this way. And I think, right, this is God. This is the first time, and it's through a dream, but it's the first time where he's really having a vision of God on his own, as far as we know. Isn't
right.
it?
Yes.
So that's telling.
And I think one of the things that we have to, and there's a lot about this that the commentators speak about with respect to the dream and what it is that Yaakov is doing now. One of the things we also have to remember is that this is the first time really since Avraham, I mean, there was a quick trip elsewhere when he went down to the Mitzrayim. This is really the first time that the state of the nation, granted, we're speaking about a very, very small number of individuals when we speak about the nation. But this is the first time that the state of the nation pivots from the land of Israel to the diaspora, which is also very troubling and may well be very troubling. Right. Yaakov has ringing in his ears the idea that he knows that his grandfather was told, if you want to become something and if you want to be the nation that you're supposed to become and you want to have a special relationship with me, then you got to get out of here. And where you have to go is to the land of Canaan. And then Avraham does that again, apart from that, you know, quick little bout in Mitzrayim. Yitzchak spends his entire life in Israel. And now this is really the first time that the story pivots elsewhere. And that is very, very troublesome, very disconcerting. And this is something that throughout the generations, when there have been these moments of exile and diaspora from the land of Israel to elsewhere, from certainly when it came to the life in the temple and the Beis HaMikdash to some other form of lifestyle, is this still going to be able to continue? Is Judaism still going to operate? Does God even care anymore? Does God care about our state if we're not in the land that he promised to have the most acute sort of relationship with us. So that may be part of what of Yaakov is really troubled by. Indeed, many explain that that is the purpose of the angels going up and down the ladder, that there are specific angels that are earmarked, if you will, for the land of Israel, and then there are others that are going to accompany him out into the diaspora. And God seems to be reminding him or encouraging him that, yes, we'll still be close, we'll still have a relationship even though you're not here, but it's going to be one of a very different nature.
And I think, again, that speaks to the idea that this has, I don't know, greater resonance, but a different level of resonance for us, because he represents maybe a personality type that the average person today can relate to a little bit more. Like, if this parsha is about something, it's about going out in the world and staying true to your vision, staying true to yourself.
Right. And hopefully along with that is a little bit of fear and concern that we might not hack it. And that there is this sense that if I'm leaving, that if I'm leaving sort of the cradle of things being very spiritual and very holy and very comfortable, then I don't know how long I'll necessarily be able to last. How long will I be able to withstand those foreign influences and the need to be able to get back to where we belong? Look, I think this is the way that we operate as Jews who are living in the diaspora, that on the one hand, we say that we can accomplish a great deal and we can develop a relationship with God no matter where we are. And God is omnipresent. And I'm sitting here in Cherry Hill and I feel very, very close to God. But at the same time, when I go to Israel, I feel that much closer to God in a way that I just can't anywhere else. And it's this very, I guess it's this great ambivalence towards where do we belong? Where ought we to be? And maybe Yaakov is the first one who really lived through that ambivalence and lack of certainty about what his fate was going to look like now that he was exiting Israel.
So let's get to, he gets back to his grandfather's hometown, and he gets to the well and meets Rachel. And this is, on the one hand, this seems like maybe the most romantic story in the Torah. It's described in terms which are, I think, seem more romantic than we're used to. Certainly you contrast it with his father, where the servant of Abraham is making the match. He sees her, and it says does he embrace her? He kisses her, says he loves her right away. Like, it's really love at first sight for them. Is this good or bad? Because it seems like, on the one hand, that love is certainly a good thing. On the other hand, it seems like it also is, the fact that he has this intense feeling for her seems to open up a can of worms.
What do you mean, a can of worms?
Well, like, it is, I mean, maybe it's less that and more the fact that he ends up being tricked into marrying her sister is really the source of the problems. But that ultimately that he has this preference, and I guess the preference itself is not the bad thing.
Yeah, I think anyone who's poised to marry somebody should have a preference for that somebody as opposed to any other somebody.
As opposed to their sister.
As opposed to their sister, at the very least, and as opposed to really anybody else. I don't know. I have a hard time with thinking about love at first sight.
Right.
I don't buy it.
This is not something rabbis usually speak in favor of.
No. Or psychologists or, marriage therapists. Because, frankly, there's no such thing. There's infatuation at first sight. There is longing and love. There's certainly lust at first sight, that's for sure. And I'm not suggesting that that's what was going on here. But there is some connection that's made very, very early on. Look, it's like, when we think about what is supposed to happen over the course of, let's say, the dating process. It's not that you are supposed to be able to know the other person to the degree that I'm certain that this is just going to be smooth sailing from here on out. It's more that recognizing all the trials and tribulations that life is going to throw at us, I'm confident enough that we have enough chemistry, I like this person enough to be able to ride out the storm and be able to keep on working and sort of go hand in hand in conquering and meeting all of life's challenges together. There is something that Yaakov feels when he sees, this has got to be the girl from the family that I'm looking for. I'm in the right place and at the right time and the stars are in alignment. And
he rolls this stone off of the well.
Yeah.
Like, he all of a sudden has like this
adrenaline rush of all time. This is like when you see those guys put like the chain in their mouths and they roll the like the you know the semis you know down the road. World's Strongest Man competition. You've clearly never watched.
We know
ESPN,
what you're doing. We know what you're doing.
ESPN
on YouTube.
3 at 4 o'clock in the morning because this is what is on.
I generally stick to like ESPN 2 or ESPN 4. 3 kind of falls through the cracks.
Okay, fair enough. I thought you were. You looked like a fan of sumo wrestling. I thought so.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. So at any rate, there's clearly some kind of connection that's made. I refuse to insert the idea of love here because.
Well, what do you mean? It says he loves her though.
We use the term ahava. We spoke about this last week, I think. We use the term ahava v'yehav and similarly we use the term sina. In the opposite context, not necessarily speaking about deep love and deep hatred, but we speak about it in terms of preference even.
I don't know. I mean, really, it says very simply, Ve'ehav Yaakov et Rachel. Yaakov, let's try to translate. Ve'ehav Yaakov et Rachel, ve'yomer e'evadcha sheva shanim b'rachel bitcha ktana. So would you say that translates to, and Yaakov had a preference for Rachel, so he said, I will work for 7 years for Rachel, your youngest daughter, or he loved Rachel and said, I will work for 7 years for Rachel, your youngest daughter. It's hard to say that that's not an emotional commitment that he's making, right?
Let me ask you something.
Yes.
Ever been to Israel?
Yes, thank God. Many times.
What do you like to eat most when you're there?
I like to eat at Kadosh, the French patisserie in Jerusalem on Sunday morning. That's my favorite spot in the world. To get a meal.
What's your favorite dish?
Oh, they have like a croque monsieur, I think. It's like it's like eggs in like a croissant and like a latte is really.
Have you ever been heard to say that I love that dish?
Absolutely. I will say it right now. I love going to Kadosh on a Sunday morning in Jerusalem.
I am not going to tell Shira that you said that.
She knows. So she knows.
Use the same term for eggs as for your wife.
But the
fact of the matter is that we use terminology in very, very broad swaths. If we're talking about the concept of love at first sight, if you're saying that the term love in that sentence refers to the same way that you feel about eggs at Kadosh, then I'm more than happy to sign on the dotted line. But if we're suggesting that, do you believe that, that Yaakov's appreciation, longing, love for Rachel on the day that she died is effectively equivalent to the degree of love that he has for her here?
No, I don't think that.
Is there another word that should be used? I think we use the term Ava in both instances, much the same way that when we say that a person hates his mortal enemy and also...
Hates getting up in the morning.
Hates getting up in the morning or doesn't appreciate one wife as much as the other. I don't know that we're dealing with the same sort of hatred.
I think that you're obviously right that the words get used in different ways, but I also think that there has to be a degree to which like the way that we understand them, like I don't think we should underestimate the fact that like there's a very, very deep feeling of love that is real that goes on between them. It's not the same as it is at the end of their lives or her life, but it's there's something very like. And I also think that the fact that you don't want to give credit to love at first sight, the fact that you want to suggest that it's a shallow kind of thing and that you have to let a relationship develop and how could you know somebody at that moment, I think makes you want to discount that it's happening here. But I think that it is happening here and maybe it's an exception that proves the rule. And I think that I think there's an intimation that something deeper is going on because it doesn't just say that he loves her. It doesn't just say that he kisses her. It says he kisses her and then he raises his voice and he cries. Like there's something extremely well either strange about that or something like very profound about that he was looking at her. And we know that this happens other times in Yaakov's life as well, that like an encounter is like laden for him with like the meaning of the echoes of things that are going to happen later on. Like I think he sees her and knows that on some level, and this is a man who is capable of prophecy, he sees her and he knows that she is his life partner, and that the road is not going to be simple with her. And I think that's a very I wouldn't want to play that down. I would want to, like, you know, accept that for being a very important part of their story and what we should take from. And not that we should go out to a well and plan on falling in love at first sight.
Yeah, I guess that's really the upshot for me.
that's not the takeaway.
Yeah, that the way in which I guess love is portrayed in so much of what we encounter in our society, I think is just a complete undermining of what love and relationships really are meant to be, and that frightens me to no end. And the last thing in the world that I would want to do is pin that kind of relationship, which is really not a relationship at all, is to sort of pin that on Yaakov as being the role model for that brand of love at first sight, quote unquote. But agreed, look, I don't need to be convinced that Yaakov was a far more perceptive human being than the rest of us, that when his antenna were out, it looked fundamentally different than, you know, whatever our sort of intangible senses might be. You know, his spider sense was tingling, that's for sure, right? He recognized that he was in the presence of somebody who was going to be his soulmate, is his soulmate, his neshama lights up, whatever it is and whatever it looks like. I would just be very, very cautious about making assumptions.
What the takeaway should be.
Oh, when I met her and we went out on our first date.
We're just
date,
like Yaakov and Rachel.
Where there was a shooting star and and the bathroom was out of order because it was flooded and it was just like the well. And, you know, who knows where this might lead. And I don't want to
proceed with caution. I think that's fair. I think a lot of the things that we see from the Avot are the lesson we take away. I think one of the last things we've been learning is the lesson you take away is not always the superficial one. But let's talk about her father for a second. Lavan, Yaakov's uncle, and kind of down in Jewish tradition as being an extremely shady character.
Right.
He's at once thought of as being like a businessman type, like the most like this worldly transactional kind of wheeler dealer. And then there's also something more menacing about him as well. We say it on Pesach, and it was said, you know, during the temple times when the first fruits were delivered, Arami Oved Avi. And we take that phrase to mean that this Aramean, meaning who they say is Lavan, sought to kill my father.
Aramean, not Armenian.
I said Aramean. Aram. It's just translated from Aram.
Aramean, not Aramean.
Right. I mean, I don't know any.
No offense to any of our Armenian neighbors.
No one from Armenia should be offended.
No Armenians were hurt in this podcast.
No. We stand with the Armenians.
Right.
But not the Arameans.
No, not with the Arameans.
Or the Arameanis?
Neither one.
Is he an Aramini?
He is the biggest Aramini in the playground.
All right, so Lavan is the Arameanian. But I was thinking in looking at the parsha, I was thinking about Bob Dylan's song, The Ballad of a Thin Man, where he says, you know something's happening here, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? Which, you know, was taken by the people listening to Dylan to be kind of like looking at the squares. Like, you know, the hippies are up to something, but you can't get on board with it and you don't know what it is. And I was thinking about that in terms of Lavan. Like, his sister left. Like, I think that that's something we don't. Like, I was thinking that Lavan is not, like, it's not that he's not understood. It's that we don't even think about him that much, other than being, like, the guy who's trying to exploit Yaakov. But his sister leaves, right? And he's sort of going on to fame and fortune or to a better life far away. And then his nephew comes and wants to marry his daughter. And, you know, at the end of this week's parsha, they kind of run away also. And he's the person who just he knows there's something special about this family, these cousins of his. But I think he doesn't get, like, in his heart of hearts, he doesn't get it. He can't relate to their spirituality, to this sort of, like, ethical stance that they stand for, the idea that God, you know, demands something of them. That's kind of how I'm thinking of him. That he's like,
do you want me to feel bad for Lavan right now? Is that where we're?
I don't think it's a question of feeling bad. I think it's a question, like, I don't think it's that he's, it's not that he's sympathetic, or, you know, but I think it's like there's more to it. Like, we think of him as being like exploitative only, but I also was thinking, like, thinking about him as being a person who is, like, just sadly can't see what's going on around him. Like, this is his, it's like his daughters and his sister. That's a lot of people who are very close to him have, like, had this conversion experience, so to speak. Like, they became, Ellen Willis, who was a, she was a music critic. She wrote this very famous article in Rolling Stone about her brother becoming Orthodox. I don't know if you've read it. It was passed around yeshiva when I was in yeshiva. It's kind of thing people would pass around. It was really interesting. And it was about, like, she spent some time in Eshet Torah with her brother, and her brother kind of went for it. And she was like, well, I see what was appealing, but it's not in me. Right. And I feel like Lavan has a little bit of that also. Like, he's just like, I don't know.
I was going to bring that up. It's interesting that you quoted that article. I was going to bring that up.
That article?
No, not that article, but that same experience. You know, the term when I was thinking of going to yeshiva in Israel, and I don't know whether the term is or is not still used, but it was brainwashing. That these young men and women live their lives a certain way and live their lives in certain communities, and then they get up and they go to Israel, and all in the span of a year, just have a complete, not necessarily about face, but are just supercharged, and they want to become that much more religious or spiritual or, you know, right wing, or, you know, dress differently. And, you know, it occurred to me even at the time that I was, you know, going through this entire process, and doing just that, that it was that nothing could be further from the truth in terms of having anybody sit you down and just, you know, indoctrinate, here, look at this, you know, spiral, black and white, curlicue on the, you know, on the screen as it spins, and, you know, we'll put you into a trance, and you will start wearing a black hat. You will start. I mean, nothing could be further from the truth. But what was actually taking place was that, in part, it is because you are, you know, I guess, removed from what you have seen around you, right? You're therefore open to new experiences, not unlike college, I suppose, right, where you go away and you're living on campus and you're away from your family and from your home, that you become more open and you're surrounded by people who are living your lives a certain way and seem to be very happy doing so and are accomplished and have achieved a great degree of scholarship, feel close to God and connected, spiritual. So it's very appealing, and it could be very, very appealing all within a very short time frame. Let's not dismiss the fact that, you know, kids are often, you know, primed for that reality from their own parents and from their own communities. And even if they're then, you know, prepared to take a much further step, let's say in that direction. But yeah, maybe there's something to that. And then you sort of go home, and what's the reaction? Oh, you must have been brainwashed. Like, there must be something wrong with you, because I just don't get it. I just don't appreciate it. I just don't understand it. And I think that is sad. I'm still not going to feel – I'm not going to feel bad for Lavan. I think that what it comes down to is, self-awareness. Try to
– It would take a lot of work for him to get there, but he could either.
Yeah, try to view life and view the world and view experience beyond just your own, beyond just the way that you would most naturally see it within the halls of your own brain or the four walls of your own brain. And it's sad that he doesn't, and it's his own fault.
Yeah, no. Again, it wasn't a call for sympathy. It was just like thinking about like the depth of his experience,
right.
And like,
yeah, I think that's true.
And his not getting it. But unlike the experience you were speaking about, where, you know, as a kid you go and you're surrounded by different people and have all these experiences which are kind of leading you closer to God, to Judaism. Yaakov has the opposite experience in this parsha. He's going to Lavan's house.
Right.
And I sort of would tie back to what I was saying in the beginning, that I think that whether interpreted the way I was thinking of it or just the dream in general is the thing that's like gives him the strength, or like the dream is like the jumping off point that he, you know, it's inspiring him. It's going to help him get through 14 years that he's going to be with Lavan. And again, I think so something that is really interesting I was looking at was when the commentaries make something of Yaakov saying, when he's talking to Rachel for the first time and introducing himself, he says, "I am your father's brother, the son of Rivka." The commentaries ask, what is he, you know, you can, you know, in the Torah, a nephew can be thought of like a brother. Lot is thought of as a brother, or Abraham sometimes.
Right.
So it's not wrong, but like, why say that extra? Why not just say, "I'm your cousin, I'm Rivka's son"? It's like an extra phrasing. And from that, you know, Rashi says, oh, you know, if he's going to treat me like Lavan, then I'm going to be his brother in deceit. Or if he's going to treat me nicely, then I'm going to be like Rivka's son. But it goes further than that. I think the Al-Sheikh really elaborates on it and talks about like the fact that that he has come from a little bit of deception. He did have this incident, and there's a degree to which he and Lavan might have more in like they might have more in common than you think. And there is, I think that makes the temptation or the possibility that Yaakov is going to be swayed by this all the more real, that he's about to get submerged into Lavan's world. And although we know the answer and we know how great Yaakov is, the reality is that he's going to stand apart, but he also really does run the risk. Unlike his father and his grandfather, who they never have a boss, right? Avraham and Yitzhak never have a boss. We know that they are raising flocks, they are planting, but we never get the sense of them working for a living, toiling the way that we do with Yaakov. And so it's really, again, sort of sounding this note of like his relevance to us and our lives. I think that the fact that he has to kind of like maintain his identity in the business world, so to speak, I think is a detail of his life that really speaks to us.
I think to some degree it could also cut in the exact opposite direction. Maybe this is what Rashi is trying to and drive at, the idea of I'm your father's brother, you know, not so much that I'm similar to him, although I am in a certain regard, but that I'm his equal. And that to some degree it might be easier.
Don't mess.
Right. It might be easier for somebody almost to, meaning to say that if I wasn't this type, then there would be greater concern. If I was more like my father Yitzchak and I had no sense of how to negotiate and even, you know, manipulate when appropriate, and I hadn't already been out in a world in which that was all necessary, then yeah, maybe your father could have just steamrolled me and I wouldn't have seen what's coming and I wouldn't have gotten it. Meaning maybe somebody who actually is lacking that experience and lacking that dimension of his personality is more at risk of succumbing and falling prey to somebody who can completely blindside him with that entire approach to life. And Yaakov's point is that, no, like, been there, done that. I know what it means to negotiate. I know what it means to even manipulate. I know what it means to be out in the world in which things are more complex. Things aren't so straightforward. Been there, lived through that, and therefore I'm going to be able to stand my ground.
So it's not that he's, like I was saying, vulnerable, that there's a vulnerability in him being seduced by Lavan and his worldliness, his presence in the business world as a businessman, but rather he's saying, no, I know what that's about, but I'm going to, he's sort of going, you're saying there's a way of looking at it where he's going in stronger, essentially.
Going in stronger because he's had, it's sort of like, it's like an inoculation, like a vaccination, right? I've already had that bacteria I've already been, you know, exposed to, or that, you know, germ I've already been exposed to, and I've already figured out what to do with it.
So there's something you spoke about on Shabbos that I related to something that I had heard. You were talking about like that in last week's Torah portion that Yaakov says to his mother, like, oh, if I get caught impersonating my brother, I'm going to be like a liar. And in fact, or I'll be like a deceiver, when in fact he is actually practicing deception. But you were saying, if I you know, got the message, that he has this vision of himself that even when he has to you know, briefly depart for very valid reasons from that vision, he doesn't want to own up to the fact, and or he doesn't want to concede that's a change in his personality, a change in direction. He's like, I'm going to swerve from my direction, but I'm going to get right back on because my sense of myself as an honest person, as a truthful person, as a person who values truthfulness is not going to be compromised by the fact that this one time, for very, very important, valid reasons, I have to do something which is a little bit below the standards that I have set for myself.
Yeah, you can expose yourself to, I guess, exceptions to the rule when the rule is very strong, right? You can branch out from your core when your core is very strong. And that was my take, that Yaakov refuses to define himself as a misateya, somebody who is deceitful, because of this particular experience or because of the particular need in this one lone, you know, scenario. And he still knows who he is.
So I thought that was interesting. I had heard the philosopher. I heard that, and this is like secondhand on a podcast I was listening to. Someone quoted the philosopher Slavoj Žižek. You know Žižek?
Oh, me and Žižek were kidding me. We're like this.
Exactly. So Žižek talks about in terms of a nation's ethos that a country which, you know, the country sometimes has to do bad things. You know, but there's a difference between a country that's like, you know, in the back of your mind, kind of like, you know, that we're conducting this war where bad things are happening versus being like, yeah, we're a nation of torturers. That like in both cases, a bad thing might be happening. But like you are in a terrible state if you can acknowledge to yourself that you are that you were just bad people.
Sure. I think there's a fundamental difference. Look, there's a difference between taking a life and murder. Right. If you are just a murderous people, then there's no reason why, let's say, going to war shouldn't be chalked up to that same, I guess, personality trait, as opposed to, no, we're basically good, honest, you know, peaceful people. But every now and again, there might be a pronounced need to, I guess, do something that goes that cuts against the grain a little bit.
I found this both, I think it was the combination of the way you expressed it in Shul and also hearing it expressed sort of on this national level that really hammered home for me what I think is something that a lot of people struggle with, which is how is it that Yaakov is associated with the characteristic of truthfulness when he seems to be, of the three patriarchs, the one who has the most slippery relationship to the truth in some cases. But it's that idea that on the one hand, what you and, you know, on the personal level and what Žižek on a national level talk about is on the one hand, it's redemptive, right? You have to be able to live with a vision of yourself that you are basically decent. But that which has a sort of a seed of hypocrisy in it could very easily become just you can completely fake yourself out and you're living a delusion and you're a terrible person. You're lying all the time. You're murdering all the time. And you are able to go home and think that I'm all right. And so I think that like it points to it really highlights the subtle characteristic of truthfulness that like there's an inner truth and there's the way that is backed up by your actions. And that is not as simple or, you know, objective as straightforward as just never tell a lie. That there's a dynamism to truthfulness and to living out your vision despite the challenges that are going to confront you that Yaakov embodies. That Yaakov, it's not that he never tells a lie. It's that he like by force of personality, by strength of personality, manages to live a life that amounts to something that is truthful, despite the fact that there are occasions when he has to step outside of that line. And I don't know that I don't know if that makes if that resonates with you, but that
it sure does 100%. And I think that you find that actually encapsulated in that line that Yaakov utters to his mother. Think about the context there. Context is that Rivka hatches this scheme: go and trick your father, and you'll get the blessing. And Yaakov's response is, I don't know, it's not going to look right. And I'm not accusing you, mommy. I'm sure that makes the most sense and that's the most proper. But how does it look? And how will my father perceive of this? And what if he finds out? And there's a certain reticence there as opposed to just say, oh, a scheme? I am all in on schemes. In fact, I just invested with this guy Madoff. And boy, does he have – I mean, we don't find that. We don't find that Yaakov is all in immediately. He hems and haws over this. Is this right? Should we do this? How's this going to look? Even if it is correct, he's also concerned about the perception. And I think in that space in which he is less than enthusiastic about the plan in the first place, that almost proves this point, that this is not really who he is. The Torah much earlier on defines him as somebody who's an ishtam. He's pure. He's wholesome. We think about the Tom from the Haggadah and from the Seder night as being somebody who's simple, you know, unadorned with the battle scars of life and the process of negotiation and living in a world that is complicated and that's nuanced and that's ambiguous. Yaakov doesn't seem to have any of that because his world is, you know, his Torah and his is the study hall and he seems to be a much more simple person at his core, and it's only that we go from there to a point of this ever unfolding story of some of his wheelings and dealings. But I think there in that conversation between him and his mother, he comes back to what his core really is, and that there's truthfulness at his core.
Very interesting. So one more thing I think let's talk about before we wrap up, because it would be really we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the switching of the bribes that Lavan, after Yaakov works for 7 years, he thinks he's going to marry Rachel, and instead Lavan, under the wedding canopy, substitutes Leah and says, we don't, when Yaakov says, I thought I was going to get Rachel, he says, we don't marry off the younger before the elder in this place. So is this the idea of Midah Keneged Midah, I guess a sort of karma, like you give what you get, or something that he fooled his father to put the younger ahead of the elder, and now the elder is being put ahead of the younger for him?
It's hard for me to accept that. That's the truth.
Okay.
Because what does that mean? That I guess it's one of two things. Either it's a suggestion that what Yaakov did was wrong, and it would be odd to see or to say that this is the only point at which the Torah says that wasn't the right thing to do. That was incorrect. Or it means that the concept of midah keneged midah, that you sort of what you give is what you get, is more arbitrary almost than a definition of were you right to have done this or are you wrong to have done this. Why should it be that Yaakov is met with deceit, inappropriate deceit, if his deception was appropriate and was, I don't know about, was lawful or was acceptable or was something that maybe it seems even his own father, who was deceived by his son, seems to be at the end of the parasha, last week's parasha, seems to be very, very
sort of concedes it.
Yeah, seems to be okay with it.
I would answer that by suggesting it is an extension of the nuance that we talked about before, in terms of it's not that the Torah is judging Yaakov as having done something wrong, but it's telling us, and again, I'm really hung up on the idea that there's this psychological depth and nuance here, that it's complicated. Like it's not that you did something wrong, something bad is going to happen to you, because looked at broadly speaking, it's not bad. The 12 tribes are born from Yaakov and Leah, from both Leah and Rachel. They are considered matriarchs. They both bring something vital to the table. They're brought in, but it's not straightforward anymore. And you want to bring nuance and complication and say things aren't so simple in this world. So sometimes Yaakov has to get up and do something that's a little bit underhanded or something that doesn't look 100%, Yashar, a little bit outside of the lines. Well, you know what? Life is going to catch up with you in that way. Not that it was wrong. It's not wrong for wrong. It's a little bit complicated for a little bit complicated.
So maybe there's something to be said for that, meaning I guess, it's hard to draw the lines between what Lavan does and what Hashem allows, right? This is always the difficulty of trying to figure out.
Well, ultimately, Hashem allows everything.
Right, where our free will ends and where God's allowance begins, his decision begins. But, was it correct for Lavan to do what he did? It doesn't seem that, there doesn't seem to be any way of justifying it. Was it correct for Yaakov to do what he did? All signs point to yes. What about the impact? And maybe that's part of it, meaning that is part of the lesson that Yaakov has to learn is you are now in a position the next morning after waking up and seeing that Leah's in the room and not Rachel, you're effectively in the same position as your father was when you deceived him. And you almost just have to put stock in the fact that God has your back, or God at least has the back of the Jewish nation in its entirety. There's nothing that's going to go so horribly awry so as to completely unravel all of Jewish destiny. And you're just going to have to wait patiently to figure out how this all comes to fruition. And like you said, indeed it does, right?
I think that's a great message, honestly. I think that makes
great.
It's a great message. No, I mean, it's something for real, for very real for Yaakov. It becomes a test of his faith, and it becomes a test of his faith that he ultimately passes. And again, if we're think if we're going to learn it that way, if we're going to understand it that way, then I think that holds a, I think that holds more than love at first sight. I think that holds a valuable lesson for us that, you know, we have to, you know, it's not as simple as, you know, when life hands you lemons, you make lemonade, but that you have to understand that just because things in the immediate term seem unfair or seem, you know, less straightforward than you would have liked them to be, that doesn't change the fact that there's, you know, either that there's a plan or that you can build something out of it.
I think what's really interesting in this conversation is the distinction that you find between the reaction of Yitzchak and Yaakov, which also is very telling, that Yitzchak has a particular plan and that plan goes awry. And what does he do about it? Nothing. He somehow or another is at peace with what to play. This wasn't what I would have done. This wasn't how I would have seen things as really going. But he's at peace with it. You know, and maybe this is actually for the best. And even though it doesn't have my seal of approval, it wasn't the plan that I wanted to see through. It doesn't have my imprimatur on it. Nevertheless, you know what? What's done is done. And I think this is going to work out just fine. And he's able, he has the strength or fortitude to maybe withdraw from this entire episode and say, yeah, sort of let things be the way that they are now. What's Yaakov's reaction? He storms through into Laban's office and demands that Rachel actually be handed over. They wait a week and then he marries her and then another 7 years, but two very different reactions. Meaning Yaakov is convinced that no, this was wrong. This is not the way that things should have been, or at least there's yet more that needs to be accomplished. And he's insistent on seeing his plan through until the end, even if it's his own plan B as opposed to his own plan A. And Yitzchak's reaction is, you know what, this isn't even my plan anymore, but I could see how this all comes to a really happy conclusion. And it's difficult to say where we should ever be in any given moment and following our own plans going awry, which category we ought to allow ourselves to fall into. But I think both are very important. Sometimes we have to just let things be the way that they are and it's all going to work out. And other times we have to really persevere and we have to see things through.
I think perhaps that brings us to a happy conclusion. And we should maybe let it be for now and let people go and get into the Parsha on their own and sort of see what they take away from it. I think this was definitely an episode where I'd love for feedback on the Facebook page here. What you got out of this? What do you think of the switch of is Yaakov, you know, is he coming on strong, ready to withstand Laban, or is he sort of walking that line and kind of needing to bolster himself throughout? The Portion Podcast is recorded in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, produced by Aaron Roller. Our theme music is The Magid's Niggin by Simply Tzvat. If you enjoy the show, please tell your friends about it any way you can. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to rate us and leave a review. And you can follow the show on Facebook. Have a good Shabbos, and remember, there is always more to learn.